This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. William Blake waxed poetic about seeing a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower. Well, David Haskell took that as a challenge. He's a professor of biology at the University of the South in Tennessee. Blake's poem inspires us to see the smallest parts of the world the world can hold within them, the complexities of a whole universe. And David decided to test that. He measured out a 1 square meter patch of old-growth forest in Tennessee. He would revisit it each week for a year to see what kind of story it told and how the story changed and how it stayed the same. What he found did indeed reveal a world filled with relationships that reflect the life of the forest and the planet itself. He has a new book called The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature. It's going to be at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh on Saturday. But first, David Haskell joins us on the phone from Tennessee. David, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us exactly what you did.
So I watched 1 square meter of forest, as you said, on a mountain slope here in Tennessee. This is a mixed deciduous forest, very similar to many of the forests in North Carolina. And I did that for two reasons. One, I wanted to go to nature without an agenda to see what would happen. I'm a teacher and a scientist, and normally I go to nature with a lesson plan or a hypothesis that needs testing, data that needs to be gathered. And those things are great, and they have their place, but I had this desire to just see without expectation what would happen. The second motivation was I wanted to tell the stories of the forest, to use what I observed in that 1 square meter as a way of structuring a narrative for a book that would tell people who are non-specialists some of the amazing stories that are out there in the woods. I had the privilege of sharing these stories with my students. We live in an unendingly remarkable world, and yet those stories are so often buried. They're so often literally unseen because they're in scientific papers, they're in conference proceedings, and few people read those. So I wanted to use this 1 square meter as a lens through which to look at forest ecology and communicate that to interested people who are not specialist scientists.
And you compare this patch of land to a mandala, the mandala of Tibetan Buddhism. Tell us about the comparison.
Sure. So the mandala is the guiding metaphor for the book, and I call my 1 square meter of forest the forest mandala. A Tibetan mandala is not usually made out of forest. It's made out of pigment or sand that is laid out in a circular pattern. And the pattern, many mandalas are about 1 square meter in size, and so there's a physical parallel there. But there's also some deeper parallels. One is the construction of the mandala, so the laying down of the colored sands in intricate patterns to make this circular symbol within the Buddhist tradition, is a device to focus our attention on one small area of the world. And more than that, the mandala, when it's completed, is a representation of the entire universe. And here, this book is not a book about Buddhism or religion. I wanted to use that as a challenge to me as a scientist to say, well, can I see the whole ecology of the forest through this 1 square meter, but by focusing my attention down and using the forest mandala as a lens through which to observe the functioning of the community of life, how all the animals and plants and fungi and microbes interacted with one another.
So tell us how the observation went. I mean, were you seated in the lotus position? Did you bring a clipboard and a notebook? How did it go? What did you do when you were there?
Okay, my knees are not flexible enough to sit in the lotus position. If I tried that, I would still be down there as a skeleton.
And you would indeed have become one with the universe.
I would. Okay. Well, we already are one. Every time you breathe in, you're sucking in the universe.
Exactly.
So I walked through the woods at the end of December and found a sandstone rock on which I thought I could sit fairly comfortably. I'd never seen this rock before. The place in front of that rock became the forest mandala. And I would go there many times a week, often once a day, sometimes several times a day. There were some times when I skipped a day or two. I would sit and observe using my senses. So I did not remove things and bring electron microscopes into play and so on. I used a hand lens and a notebook, but beyond that, it was through my sight, through the smells and the sounds of the forest that I tried to be open, to open my senses to see what was happening there. And then when things would happen, as every day something new would be happening in that one square meter, I'd then make notes, I'd identify the creature in question, and then all these questions would appear in my head, and I would scuttle back to the library to research what other people had written about the phenomenon that I'd just seen in the forest. So this became, a lot of it was about observing in the forest. A lot of the project was about digging into the scientific literature to find out more about the things that I'd been seeing out in the forest to help me put that into context.
Now, one of the things that happens, of course, is when you dig into that literature, you find out about relationships, but they're always written from the point of view of a kind of a subject object. There's somebody who's looking at this phenomena or series of phenomena,
right,
and they're describing relationships, but they all have their own particular roles. Were you ever able to dissolve that vision?
I think one of the things that I got from this, I wasn't able to completely dissolve that. We all obviously exist as separate individuals and bring a certain amount of separation into any relationship. But sitting in the forest for so many hundreds of hours really opened to me the way in which all of us, humans included, all the creatures in the forest, are tied into networks. So just by being present in the forest, you immediately become connected into that network. So when I walk in the woods, at first I thought, well, I'm walking quietly here. I'm just observing the woods as they are. It turns out if you sit very quietly for several hours on one rock, the forest's acoustic network quiets down and forgets that you're there. And then when another human walks past on a trail down the mountainside, you realize the extent of the disturbance that we create as we move through the forest. The birds start chipping with their alarm notes, the chipmunks and then the squirrels pick up on the alarm. And so we're preceded by a bow wave of acoustic communication among the creatures in the forest. Long before a human arrives, its effects have already been found. And the same is true for other large animals like foxes moving through the woods or crow flying through the canopy. It's not just humans who cause those things.
So there's this part in the book where you decide to strip down. It's freezing cold outside. You
right.
want to experience it the way animals do mm-hmm. in the wild. Tell us what you learned from that.
So one of the most remarkable things I think about the forest in the wintertime is that there are animals out there who weigh just a few pennies. So a chickadee, for example, weighs about as much as 3 pennies. And yet it survives without, a Kroger supermarket down the road, without a nice thermal underwear and without heating services provided by an apartment complex and so on. It's just out there on its own in nature. How is this possible? Well, one way to get at that is through a sort of intellectual engagement with that. I wanted to, as I did in many other instances, engage with that physically, to really feel what that was like to be out there, an animal unaided by technology. And it turned out I lasted about a minute before I started shivering so uncontrollably and my subconscious mind launched into alarm. I just couldn't make it. So what did that teach me? It taught me first the nature of my being as a tropical primate. I have none of the abilities that the other organisms around me have in order to cope with the forest. And then the chickadees and the other birds that were sort of dancing above me as I did this absurd striptease, how do they do it? Well, it turns out they have twice as many photoreceptors in the back of their eyes. So where I see just a little twig, they see a whole fractured world filled with little spider eggs and other little pieces of food. So where I can't feed myself in the woods, they really can, partly because of their eyesight. They have extra layers of insulation. They also have a physiology that's geared so that they can generate a lot of heat from their food quite quickly. The other thing, though, is that many chickadees don't survive, and that has all sorts of effects that echo through the rest of the forest ecology. So those very cold winter nights, have a remarkable effect that goes beyond just the effect on the individuals that either live or die. The fact that we have a horde of migrant birds moving through the southeastern U.S. now, it's April, migration's underway. Why are those birds here? They're here because there's a flush of food that the resident birds can't gobble up. Why not? Because the resident birds' populations are kept in check by our hard winters. So from a seemingly insignificant little chickadee feeding in the woods, we can look out into the bigger world and start to understand global patterns, like why some animals migrate thousands of miles in order to take advantage of our summertime.
In addition to these sort of global visions that it gives us access to, you also look at the micro level, the codependency of moss and fungi, and you found that instructive as well.
Exactly. As you focus in, you realize that the world is ruled by a tiny proletariat that are mostly invisible to us. We can't see the microbes of the soil, although we can smell them, and in some of the chapters I describe how to get down and actually smell the microbial world that's under our feet, mostly hidden from us. But all those little organisms live as individuals, but they're tied together in mutual dependencies. So, for example, lichens are an amalgam of a fungus and either a bacterium or an alga. On their own, either partner really can't function very well. But when they unite into a union that is motivated by self-interest on both parts, they can conquer the world. In fact, 15% of the world's land surface is covered with lichens. They're very humble little creatures, but they're quite successful. That's true at the small level. It's also true at the larger level, in that every cell in our bodies as animals has little ancient bacteria hidden within, and those are the bacteria that we use to process our food. And so we're Russian dolls in a way. We're formed out of at least a couple of individuals have fused their bodies to produce what we now call the animals. The same is true with trees. Most trees in the forest are connected to a below-ground network of fungi that feed the minerals and in exchange the fungi get photosynthetic materials like sugars and perhaps proteins back from the plants. So wherever we look in nature, we see these self-interested unions between very different partners resulting in success. And that's a really important thing to emphasize, I think, because a simplistic presentation of evolutionary biology tends to emphasize the selfish, robber-baron aspect of how the world lived, nature red in tooth and claw, everyone out for themselves. And competition is indeed an important driving force in evolution. But the way that competition gets expressed is often through individuals joining together and working together towards a common goal that benefits them both. And most of the big evolutionary transitions in life were accomplished through that mechanism, not through an individual acting alone. And the observation of this one square meter just brought that home again and again. There'd be creatures working together or their lives made possible by other hidden lives within them.
I was wondering if you were able to really see anything in a new way for you as a scientist, because you bring the language of science to this. You can identify the animals, the species, even the processes. They all have their vocabulary. And I wonder if in some ways that inhibits your ability to see things in a new way, because you know what it's called.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. That's one that probably I can't fully answer, because we never know the limitations of our own sensory abilities and the filters that we bring. I think on balance, knowing the names of things helps. If we get obsessed by just pinning everything with a name and that's enough, then I agree that that is not the best way to experience the world. It's just too tidy. Nature and life are very chaotic and are continually in flux, and so they often life doesn't conform to our desire to put things into tidy categories. But knowing who the players are, or at least who some of the players are, really helps understand the nature of the play and the dynamics among those players. But one of the things I realized more and more as the year wore on was, even though I'm quite good at identifying lots of things in the forest, there were thousands of species present that I could not identify and have no hope of ever identifying because they haven't been studied and named, particularly on the microbial and the fungal level. There's such an enormous amount of mystery in the world. New things to be discovered about interactions, about identities of these organisms. So I was left with this feeling of connection to the forest, but also of not quite alienation, but a sense of distance in that this is so far beyond what my mind can grasp.
Did it change the way you see science, or did it change the way you see your job as a scientist, as a professor?
Yeah, well, part of what I gained as a scientist and as a teacher is that by going back to the library and reading more about what I saw, I just learned a lot more about the world and have many more stories to share with my students. There were many specific things. In fact, I have a whole notebook full of ideas, scientific ideas that came from observing in the forest. One of them that is on my mind a lot at the moment, given that we're moving through spring right now, is the changing nature of light in the world. Obviously, light increases and decreases in intensity, but the shape of the light spectrum changes quite dramatically as the year wears on. So in spring now, we're swamped with light green colors. When that canopy fills out, below the forest canopy, it's going to be very dark, and most of the colors in the forest will be completely unavailable for communication among animals. For example, red gets filtered out by the forest canopy. So little woodpeckers that live below the forest canopy that have red crests are hidden. They're cryptic, except when they step into a fleck of light that's coming down in a shaft from the canopy above. So they have this option of either being hidden or being fully on display, depending on how they position themselves in the variegated light spectrum.
David Haskell, to find out more, we're going to have to visit with you at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences on Saturday, but thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
David Haskell is a professor of biology at the University of the South in Tennessee. He will be at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh on Saturday. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.